Atlantis, the Lost Continent, presented by Radio Canada International. This program is the first in a series of four on Atlantis, created, researched, and produced by Robert Zenn. In this program, four roads to Atlantis. Why just four roads? Of course, you may find this title strange and think that there must be more than four, at least as many as the number of investigators. Each seeker clears his own path, as it were. It would be safe to say that during the centuries, more has been written about Atlantis than about any other problem. A bibliography compiled by two French scholars, J. Gattafossé and C.C. Roux, as far back as 1920, listed more than 1,700 books and papers, both scientific treatises and works of fiction. Since then, in the past 57 years, this number may have easily doubled. It may very well be that all these seekers cleared their own paths, yet all paths lead into four main roads, and these are the mythological, the historical, the scientific, and the mystical. Let me introduce you, then, to four seekers traveling the main roads to Atlantis. We selected them quite carefully. There are no adventurers or occasional enthusiasts or shallow best-seller seekers. All four of them have sacrificed long decades, if not their whole lives, to the research of the lost continent and its never-ceasing magic. First, the comparative mythologist. You will hear an 80-year-old scientist, the doyen of today's Atlantologists, and a member of the Royal Society of England. His name is Egerton Sykes, and he's interviewed by Canadian poet and broadcaster Robert Zend in Brighton, England.
Mr. Sykes, what made you the greatest living expert on Atlantis today?
Well, what originally happened was I was a small child living in Belgium, and a friend brought me round a copy of a book by Jules Verne called 80,000 Leagues Under the Sea. In it I came across the famous portion where Captain Nemo, descending from the submarine Nautilus at the bottom of the sea, turns to his friend and says, "Those are the ruins of the long-lost Atlantis." That fired my imagination, even as a small child. And from then onwards, I started on a diet of what you might call romantic semi-science fiction, because science fiction had not been invented in those days, in order to give myself ideas on it. When the First War started, I was in the army. I landed in France at the beginning of October 1914, and I stayed there for several years. And I was lent a copy of a book by Ignatius Donnelly, called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. That fired my imagination again to such an extent that from the end of the First World War until now, I have been not only a fervent enthusiast for Atlantis, but I have made a point of contacting everybody about who was in the slightest degree interested in it, no matter what their nationality or whether their opinions agreed with mine. It made no difference at all. My magazine Atlantis, in which I have published everybody's ideas, including my own, is now in its 28th year. And when I came back to England, I had already made plans for the starting of the Atlantis Research Centre, which still functions after all those years.
Our second seeker, representing the historical approach, is Princess de Ruspoli in Tangier, Morocco.
My name is Marta de Chambrun Ruspoli. You want me to say that I'm Princess Ruspoli? I won't say that, because I don't believe in titles. I believe that nobility exists in the head and in the heart, and there is no other. And I've worked on a book called The Divine Hawk, and now I'm working on a second book, which is called Christians Before Christ, and which is indirectly a sequel of the other. and Gavin Maxwell corrected my English translation of my book. And Gavin Maxwell said to me, I think you're right. I'm completely convinced by your theory. But it's going to take a lot of time before people realize that it's the right theory. You see, when you come to people and you tell them that Eden and the world started in the West and not in the East, as they have absolutely decided that everything came from the East, well, they've spent so much money writing and published so many books and have got so many libraries that when you come and tell them not at all, it did not begin in the East, it began in the West, they don't like it. I've read the whole book. Don't have any doubts in your mind. You have found the truth.
What is this truth?
The truth of the book is that the world was probably the civilization, primitive civilization of the world and the great civilization, was formed in Atlantis. And this idea of the creation of man and all that, and of a wonderful type of man, was probably in the Atlantis, and everything was destroyed by the crash of Atlantis, and there were only very few survivors.
I would like to ask you how you got involved into the research of Atlantis. What gave you the first impetus? Because everybody has his own personal story regarding Atlantis.
Well, I had just had a very great sorrow, the death of my daughter. And I needed to have my mind occupied by things that would take me quite out of the contingencies. My daughter died in 1953, and I began then to study. And I've studied ever since. And all the time I find new things, new texts, and of course my last years of work at the Vatican Library have been extremely profitable, and I have thousands of pages of notes.
Now, the third road, the scientific, represented by Dr. Manson Valentine, who just a few years ago discovered the famous underwater Bimini ruins at the northwestern edge of the sunken continent. Toronto filmmaker Noel Moore was invited to Miami Beach, and while in the midst of preparation for the filming of the underwater and aerial expedition, he recorded his conversation with Dr. Valentine.
I wanted to find evidence for Atlantis through zoological channels, through my work in zoology and zoogeography and whatnot.
You are, that is your...
I'm a paleontologist and a zoologist.
Mm-hmm.
When I was exploring caves of the Appalachian system, I discovered a whole fauna of cave beetles, blind cave beetles, incapable of existing outside limestone caves.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased to note that many of the genera, the new genera that I found, had counterparts in Europe, which, of course, suggests either continental drift or an Atlantis. The continental drift is a little bit hard to visualize since the amount of time necessary for separating the continents to the extent that they are now apart would not account for the beetle similarities, since these beetles are relatively recent in geologic time, like all modern insects.
Mm-hmm.
Beetles are not anything that existed in the Paleozoic phase. So there must be some other explanation for this, and the only one I could come up with was in Atlantis.
And finally, the fourth road, the mystical. Its representative, James Sturzaker in London, England, the founder of the International Order of Kabbalists, a fast-growing religious organization which has 11 chapters in the London area, 9 in the provinces, 6 in Nigeria, 2 in Ghana, 1 in Zambia, others in America, Spain, and even in Kathmandu.
I'm James Sturzaker. Before I give you my thoughts and ideas on Atlantis, I think I had better give you a little background as to how I became interested in the out-of-way things of life. At the age of 14, I purchased a book called Atlantis by Ignatius Donnelly. And then from there, I looked into very many other occult subjects, eventually joining the Theosophical Society in England, where I had the use of their library and their groups and did a great deal more studying in the occult field, covering a very, very wide range of subjects. I lectured for a number of years for the Theosophical Society, and for a period of time sat on their National Executive Committee. It then came to my knowledge that many people, particularly young people, were beginning to come interested in the order of Kabbalism. This is a very, very ancient spiritual teaching that goes way back, as far as can be traced, to the Egyptians. Later, taken by the Jews when they were captive in Egypt and adapted to their religion. For many years, the Kabbalah was divided into two sections: the Tree of Life, which was preserved by the Jews, and the Path, or the Tarot, as it is known today, which was preserved by the Gypsies. About 20 years ago, the two things came together again. My wife and I decided that as young people were looking for some form of spiritual teaching, it was up to us to do something about it. And so we formed the International Order of Kabbalists.
It's a well-known fact that Plato was the first to inform the world about Atlantis. All books on Atlantis start with Plato. Well, in our programs, we'll prove that this statement just isn't true, simply because Plato wasn't the first at all. But we'll stick to the good old habit and ask Edgerton Sykes about Plato's Atlantis.
Well, actually, Plato is the first source on Atlantis on whom we have a reasonable documentation. But he's by no means the first authority. 200 years before Plato, Solon, the Onassis of his day, the richest man in the eastern Mediterranean, a ship owner, a trader, and also a mastermind in politics, decided during one of his periods when he was out of office that he would visit Egypt, and while there, he would investigate the stories which had come to him about the existence of an earlier culture named Atlantis outside the Pillars of Hercules. Because of its political and economic importance, Solon was royally entertained during the whole of his stay in Egypt, and at one period he arrived at the Temple University of Sais, now a heap of rubble a few miles from Tanta in the Nile Delta, but then one of the most important educational centers in the known world. While there, he was entertained at dinner by the high priest, and at the close of the meal, he made the usual mistake, which many foreigners make in another country, of boasting about the achievements of the Greeks and decrying those of the Egyptians. The high priest was somewhat offended at this and turned to him and said, "You Greeks have no early history worthwhile talking about. If you want to know what early history is like. Come with me, and I will show you the records of every high priest who has held office here since the fall of Atlantis 9,500 years ago. And he proceeded to do so. And on the basis of this, when Solon returned to Greece, he just had sufficient time before going to politics again to write a poem called Atlantikos, which unfortunately was never published. 200 years later, Critias, the friend of Plato, recollected that as a small boy, his grandfather had told him of meetings with Solon, then, I presume, in his old age, during the course of which Solon mentioned the existence of this manuscript poem which he had written, and said that he was firmly convinced that there had been a civilization outside the Pillars of Hercules called Atlantis. On the basis of this data from his friend Critias, Plato decided to visit Egypt to make inquiries on his own. Unfortunately, Egyptian religion had gone very much downhill during the 200 years since the visit of Solon, and there was not a single priest available who was able to interpret the hieroglyphics of Sais or any of the other temples to the satisfaction of Plato. The result is that Plato's two papers, the Critias and the Timaeus, one of which he was unable to finish because of his death, are based very largely upon the information originally obtained by Solon and passed on to Plato by Critias, plus the interpretations which Plato himself put upon them. I would, however, observe that within the last year or so, it has become apparent that other earlier sources had had contact with the post-Atlantean remains on the western side of the Atlantic. I refer to the Orphic Argonaut, which was written about BC 1500, where reference is made to the plain of Lycontia, surrounded by a string of islands, which were pierced by the trident of Poseidon, with the result that the Atlantic Ocean rushed in and drowned all the people out on the fertile plain. The string of islands were the West Indies. The Lycontian plain is now the Caribbean, or Caribbean, whichever pronunciation you prefer, sea. And this shows that at least 1,000 years before Solon, there was communication of some kind across the Atlantic, probably Egyptians or Phoenicians, who had brought back these stories of the flooding of the plain surrounded by the West Indies. And I am absolutely certain that if we investigate with greater care the early classical sources preceding Solon, we shall find considerably more data to bolster up our ideas. I may say that there are other parts of the world from which stories come on Atlantis which are worthy of consideration, but that is another question.
We're in Tangier again. After having introduced herself, now we ask Princess Ruspoli to introduce her historical approach.
So I began to study, and I began to realize that there were the main differences between people were the differences of religion. That the religions built a wall around people. If it had been that way always, well, that meant that when the Greeks, who are our first historians, wrote, for instance, the history of the Egyptians, that they might have been wrong, because there was a religious wall between them and ancient Egypt. The Egyptians didn't speak for themselves because when the Greeks wrote about them, the hieroglyphs were hardly read, and the Egyptian had been conquered, and they had very little to say. I found that this wall did exist, and that the Greeks had understood nothing at all. If they had understood nothing at all, it meant that there was perhaps something that might be found by studying the Egyptian texts. It was then that a friend gave me the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is a collection of papyri. Papyri are pergamena, this paper that was made out of reeds in Egypt, and that were put in the tombs. They were supposed to help the dead on their journey towards the land of their ancestors. What was the land of their ancestors? Why did they have a land of the ancestors? And why did they have to go back to the land of the ancestors? Well, the hymns to the sun gave me an answer to that question. I read them over and over again and couldn't understand them at all, until I came upon one small sentence. It was, addressing the sun, "Thou comest forth from the waters." Well, I said to myself, if I am an Egyptian standing with my 2 feet on Egyptian soil, and if I watch the sun rise, and if I see the sun rise out of the waters, these waters can only be the Red Sea, which begins at the Suez Canal, or the Indian Ocean, which begins at Aden. That is the whole length of Egypt. And the souls of the east welcomed the sun, and the souls of the west awaited him. Therefore, it went on, since it was going on towards the souls of the west that were waiting. Thereupon, the sun left Egypt and began to go over the immense Saharan region, which crosses the whole center of North Africa. This enormous region is described, for instance, there's a moment when there is a land which, instead of welcoming the sun, is sad when the sun rises and welcomes the setting sun. Why? This land is called Narezruft. So I said to myself, that is the Tanezruft. It's this hell of heat which is in the Sahara, and which of course welcomes the setting sun, that is, the coming of coolness in the evening. One point after another, the Saharan toponymy, by toponymy we mean the science of names, toponymy, that these names in the Sahara of today were in the Egyptian texts of several thousands of years ago, and that you could trace them. Thereupon, the sun went further. It reached the pillars of the sky. What were these pillars of the sky? They were the highest mountain of North Africa, which is the Atlas. Well, these pillars of the sky, which are in the Egyptian text, are also mentioned by Homer and by Hesiodus. And Hesiodus says, Atlas, who at the end of the world holds up the sky on his mighty arms. And Homer says, Atlas, who contemplates the depths of the ocean. From the Atlas Mountains, the sun gets to the Atlantic Ocean at Tamanu. Tamanu Ta in Egyptian means earth. It means the same thing in the Berber language of today, Tamashek, which is spoken from the Atlantic Ocean right across Africa. The Tamashek still says Ta for earth. Well, Tamanu was the land of the setting sun. Thereupon, the sun plunges over the Atlantic Ocean. And then it comes over a region where there are the devourer of fishes, huge fishes. Well, curiously enough, that region would perhaps coincide with the path of whales, which is still followed by whales nowadays. Beyond that, there is the mountain of fire, which spits fire, and which is three times higher than three times that the mountain should be coming out of the sea. Well, this mountain could be the tide of the Canary Islands, which is the largest emergent volcano of the Atlantic, and which is the highest peak of the Atlantic. Then the sun goes on and on over regions until suddenly it comes over the region of fire. And that could be a reminiscence of the disappearance of Atlantis in the sea. It says, "Thy waters are on fire, and the streams within thee burn with fire. No one can come near, and the dead that are beneath the waters, they have died in fear." And there are those terrible descriptions of death in the waters of fire. Well, this led me to think that the country where the Egyptians went back in the west, which they called Amentet, and that Amentet, which was the island of fire, the island from which Horus escaped at the moment of the great inundation, that the inundation of the deluge was contemporary to the sinking of Atlantis in a world of fire of the volcanoes, which are along the ocean rift, which has recently been discovered by the American Oceanographic Expedition.
What's the orthodox interpretation of these names, different from your interpretation?
Those names were never interpreted and never brought together with the names of the Egyptian papyri until I did so. There I think I'm certainly the first.
How is it possible that they didn't match them with existing North African names?
They never knew. They always thought that whatever the Egyptians wrote was just fancy.
Mythology.
They didn't... The mythology... And they didn't take it to have a real background, which was a concrete background and not a background of fantasy.
So your first discovery was that are the mythological names, which they consider mythological names, were real geographical names?
Were real geographical names.
listen to Dr. Manson Valentine again, interviewed by Noah Moore before their expedition to the underwater structures built by Atlanteans more than 10,000 years ago.
Can I continue on this then, Doctor? You found these beetles, and it was obvious that continental drift theory could not account for their presence in America.
True.
And the similarity between their men
yes.
and others in Europe. So did you, where did you...
Well, I started traveling and doing island work, island surveys in both oceans. I found in the Pacific a center of dispersal. It was almost imperative. We almost have to admit that there was once a center of dispersal for organisms and even mankind in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
In the Atlantic, it's the same story.
A center of dispersal. That means you tracked down through various artifacts. You tracked down the origin of...
The origin, exactly. And in archaeology, it is admitted today by our archaeologists that all of the tools in the Pacific had a central origin.
The tools used. The by tools used. Men.
Yes, the axes, the greenstone axes, the poi grinders, and whatnot. There must have been this center of dispersal. As far as the animals are concerned, the endemic insects, mollusks and so on, the snails, land snails, they can't get around unless they are transported.
Mm-hmm.
Not by environment, because that's not capable of doing it, but by man. Well, if you rule out that, you have a tremendous fauna, which obviously has its roots in a central dispersal zone. Mm-hmm. Then you have evidence for a submerged continent.
And was this true in the Pacific? Does it refer to Lemuria? Or
yes, exactly. Sure. It was there. No doubt about it. No, I just was going to mention the fact that there are genera of snails, mm-hmm. land snails, that simply don't get around. They can't survive immersion in salt water.
Mm-hmm.
And these are confined to the Pacific. There have been no records of these particular forms on any of the continents. They are definitely Pacific. And the same is true of many insects, especially the beetles, which I've been working on.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they had to originate
and plants.
They had to originate in some land area.
Yes, absolutely. The distribution is such that it paints a very vivid picture of the demise of an area that once was their home ground.
Is there any documentation on this, Doctor? Any?
Not yet. I'm working on it.
And the same thing you would say applies to the Atlantic. Like somebody mentions, the Russian study mentions carp, for instance, freshwater fish found
yes.
on both sides of the Atlantic. And he points out that there's absolutely no way that they
no way.
Got over in a saltwater environment.
No way.
In Brighton, England, with Edgerton Sykes. We asked him to talk about mythology, comparative mythology, and its value.
One of the things in dealing with history is that once you get before the days when you had documents written, everything had been handed on by somebody else. Now, Roman mythology was taken over and adapted from that of the Greeks. Greek mythology was taken over from two distinctly different sources. One, their predecessors in the Mediterranean, and the other, the Egyptians. The combination of the two, the Egyptian mythology reaching them mainly through the Phoenicians, produced the Greek myth. But don't forget that the wars of the Titans and the giants and all that all occurred thousands of years before the first Greek arrived in the Mediterranean. They are the stories of the peoples who were there before them. Well, the story of Atlantis is in exactly the same field. It has been handed down from one generation to another, from one tribe to another, from one conquered race to their conquerors. And it is mainly due to the fact that when a race was conquered, many of their people became servants and looked after the children of the conquerors. And it is in the stories that they told of their past histories that have given us the mythology of the Romans, of the Greeks, of the Phoenicians, of the Egyptians, and of practically every other race known to man. Atlantis has had a succession of inheritors over the years, and each one of whom has, to the best of his or her ability, passed on to succeeding generations the knowledge of the great culture, the great civilization of the past, from whence all our cultural ideas and aspirations of today may be said to spring. I felt that one of the things needed to establish the credibility of Atlantis is a chain of events leading from the time of Atlantis until the present day. You cannot merely say Atlantis existed in BC 10,000. Atlantis vanished, finish. Nothing more. Nothing in this world vanishes. There are always survivors, there are always traditions, there are always things carrying on. And I feel myself that we are gradually making use of myth and legend, which in another place I have described as history seen through the eyes of children, to enable us to build up a credible and reasonably accurate picture of where Atlantis was, and to identify a few small portions of it.
Children, what do you mean?
By children, I am referring to people who have, shall we say, immature outlooks. Quite a lot of us are children when we are dealing with technologies of which we are not aware. But I can give you a very good example of this from one of the Irish stories. I think it was Maeldun who, on one of his journeys, observed what he described as an island, the city of which was perched on top of a large grey pillar. Well, that, of course, to us, merely indicates that he saw a volcano with a cloud of smoke rising from it, which had so partially given the appearance of a solid disk at the top, perhaps a couple of miles up. The reason for the misunderstanding was very simple, that there were no volcanoes in Ireland, and it's very doubtful if any of the people concerned had ever seen a volcano before. Well, now, they were not telling lies. They were telling the truth absolutely as they saw it. The fact that their opinions were mistaken, their conclusions unjustified, has nothing whatsoever to do with it. We, with our superior knowledge at the moment, can sort out from their story exactly what happened. And this is precisely the same with all the legends of the past. There were no gods, there were no goddesses. It's very doubtful if there were any real heroes. Past history is made up of ordinary people like you and I, facing difficulties, trying to surmount them, and, as usual, not really completely understanding what was happening around them, but not being any the worse for that. And I think myself that one of the greatest tragedies of today is that many of the official historians of the world look with contempt upon myth and legend, not realizing that where there is no history, myth and legend are the only sources of information on which we have to draw, and we neglect to use them at our peril.
Having followed the sun on his way from east to west, over North Africa and the Atlantic Ocean, Princess Ruspoli has led us to the region of fire where once Atlantis sank. The sunken continent underfoot, we stop here now.
Could you tell me something about the sinking of Atlantis?
Well, the sinking of Atlantis I would bring together with the notion of the underworld. Nearly all civilizations have a notion of the underworld. Out of the depths have I cried to thee, Lord, Lord, hear my voice. What does that mean? It means an underworld. It means a sunken world. Well, how did this notion enter the human mind? It entered it, according to my idea, if I may say so, through a sinking of an enormous part of the world with the men, the women, the children, and its whole life. And from then on, the underworld began to be peopled with myths. It was peopled by the souls, by the bodies of the dead who had gone down in this great sinking, like an enormous grave. Now, you find remembrances of it everywhere. You find them in the terrible night when the Atlantis went down and when the ocean closed over the Atlantis. You find allusions to it in all sorts of religious texts. The volcanoes, the seismicity of the mid-Atlantic ridge, which has now been found out technically, well, is already mentioned in many ancient religious books, among them the Book of Enoch, and among them you have quotations like this: a fire is kindled in mine anger and shall burn into the lowest hell and shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. What is that? It's a precise description of Atlantis. That's in the Deuteronomy 32:22. Well, you have in the Egyptian text, O city which is in the abyss, which covers the bodies, no one can come out, and no one can penetrate because of the great fear. And the dead who are down have been exterminated. All the legends have this, as well as the religions. The soul of Christ, after his death, descended into hell. There is an apocalypse of Andrew and Paul, which says that Paul went into the abyss and saw the empty doors of the dwellings of the souls that had been liberated by Christ. The Quran has many allusions to it. It says when God became angry while he kindled the great fire which roared in the depths.
Is it possible that they referred to the underworld because they buried the dead in the earth?
Well, surely not, because that there is no underworld, there is no issue to that. It's just you put a body in a little bit of earth near the surface. That has nothing to do with these great depths. Out of the depths have I cried to thee. Those are depths, that's not a little grave on a hill.
So water and the bottom of the ocean is always connected with death.
It's connected with death, is connected with collective death, with sunken cities. It's connected with a sunken land.
It's a domain of the dead.
It became the empire of the dead. And it became the empire of the dead because the empire was founded when Atlantis went down. That is the foundation of the submarine empire of the dead. The Sheol, hell, the hell of fire, the hell of the craters of the volcano in which Horus precipitated Set. All these traditions point to the same thing, an immense tragedy which was cosmic
and which entered the divine sphere. It was probably the deluge, because the deluge, which was this primeval drama, was remembered by humanity. It was when humanity's memory was already formed, and the deluge is probably contemporary with Atlantis.
It's time we heard about the occult Atlantis. Mr. James Sturziker.
In the occult teachings, as put out by Madame Blavatsky in her Secret Doctrine, there have been many waves of humanity that have trod this planet of ours. These have been divided up in what, to occultists, are called root races. The first two root races were of etheric and astral bodies. Therefore, nothing can be left for us to discover about them. But then, as the bodies of man densified, we had the third root race, which is known as Lemuria, and that was a continent that existed in the Pacific. All that is left of that is Australia, the islands that we call Japan. A similar sort of catastrophe happened here that happened to Atlantis. Now, Atlantis, in occult teachings, is the fourth root race. It was a civilization that rose up to great heights, and if we can believe what the occult teachings tell us, destroyed themselves by reaching to a point of discovery of power that mankind has now reached again in what is known as the Aryan or the fifth root race. Perhaps if we can take the occult side of Atlantis seriously and see from the practical side what happened to it, man might take a warning from the past that what happened then could again happen now. But let us look more into the occult side of Atlantis. One of the things that has interested me greatly in the mystical Kabbalah and its Tree of Life is the fact that it goes back to the Egyptians. From Plato's story, the Egyptian priesthood were trained by the Atlantean priesthood. This is confirmed to some degree by Iamblichus, a Neoplatonist of the 4th century. He was born AD 250 and died AD 330. He studied in the Porphyry in Alexandria. An Egyptian initiation, as recorded by Iamblichus, is thought to have been in use in the time of the Ramesses. An Egyptian initiation by Iamblichus was translated from the original manuscript by P. Christian, who was the mouthpiece of a French secret society. In the book, An Egyptian Initiation, there are described 22 murals that are hanging around the wall of the initiation chamber. And the would-be initiate priest is told by his guide to study them carefully to such a degree that he can understand the hidden mysteries behind them, because upon his understanding will depend whether he passes the initiation and enters into the priesthood. Those murals are today known as the 22 cards of the major arcana of the tarot. These are also the 22 subjective paths on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Although we can trace these murals back, trace these tarot cards back, where did the Egyptian priesthood first obtain these great deep teachings? Only from a more advanced priesthood than themselves. Again, from occult teachings, we are given to understand that the Atlantean priesthood taught the Egyptian priesthood when Egypt was a colony of this great continent. Madame Blavatsky, in giving us a great deal of information on Atlantis, obtained this information herself through what might be called the masters, or those spiritual beings who dwell on higher planes. This might be referred to as taking things through at a psychic level. And as we know, things coming through on a psychic level are always subject to a lot of doubt. But so many things in Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine, which was published in 1875, just 100 years ago, which at the time were completely unknown, have now been proved to be correct. So that if things have been proved in one field, why should not her information on Atlantis also be correct? If so, then it gives a greater importance to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, because we are looking into a spiritual way of life that was taught 10,000 BC at least, because we are not sure how long this great civilization existed with its mystical teachings prior to its destruction.
Innumerable small paths have run into four main roads, and the time has come when even these four roads must melt into one. The solution to the Atlantis problem can be reached only by interdisciplinary science. In program two, you will hear about the Atlantis Lust Revived by Ignatius Donnelly and The Sleeping Prophet, Edgar Cayce. In this program, the speakers were Edgerton Sykes, Princess Marta de Ruspoli, Dr. Manson Valentine, and James Sturziker. Our series on Atlantis was created and produced by Robert Zend, with co-production and direction by Tim Wilson and Len Shear for Radio Canada International. Dr. Manson Valentine and James Sturziker. Our series on Atlantis was created and produced by Robert Zend, with co-production and direction by Tim Wilson and Len Shear for Radio Canada International.